Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green with Bhavani on the Progressive Radio Network. And my show today is going to be another wonderfully exciting show. I have two guests today, Priscilla Timberlake and Lewis Friedman. They are co-authors of a great new cookbook called The Great Life Cookbook. And I'm going to be inviting them on in a little while to talk about their philosophy and their cookbook. But before I do, I want to just share with you some of the things that have been going on in my world here in New York on Long Island. First off, as many of you know, last week I was at the American Farmland Trust rally up in New York, and that was just a great experience. And then last Thursday after my show, I went to the Sustainable Institute at Molloy College for a screening of The Island President, which was a fascinating film about President Mohamed Nasheed, who was president of the Maldives, and that's 1,200 islands in the Pacific off of India. And it was a fascinating film looking at his take on climate change and how that is going to be the end of their world as they know it. And climate change, where we're all maybe concerned about it, but we know we can move inland if floods come and more storms like Hurricane Sandy. But for them, they're on an island, and if the sea raises, you know, 3 feet, they are completely underwater. They have no options. And so he really saw climate change as really a matter of survival for their whole country. And he was instrumental in pushing through some bills or some writing at the Copenhagen Climate Summit in 2009. And he was just a real mover and a shaker. I mean, there was a signing of some huge paper underwater, everybody in their scuba gear. It was pretty amazing. But anyway, it was a great film. If you get a chance to see The Island President, I recommend it. And they are actually having another screening as well at the Sustainability Institute in Molloy on April 11th. This is another wonderful film called A Place at the Table. And we saw a screening of this, or a little pivot of it, at TEDx Manhattan this last month. And Jeff Bridges is in it. It's a film really looking at the issue of hunger in this country. So I highly recommend that. Again, it's on April 11th. Also, a few other events coming up. On March 23rd, this weekend, there's a garden skills workshop being sponsored by Fox Hollow Farms and the Small Farm Initiative in Long Island. They're actually doing a series of four workshops. And the first one is basic vegetable gardening for beginners. And then another one is transplanting seedlings and growing seedlings. Another one is about tools. And there's a fourth one. So anyway, if you are interested, I do have them listed on my website at iegreen.com. Also, March 29th and 30th, next weekend, is the Just Food Conference. A great event. I really recommend you going. And if you are looking for any type of foodie job, there will be a job market at the close of the conference. So that's a worthwhile thing to go to as well. On April 17th, Saru Jayaraman is having a book signing for her new book, Behind the Kitchen Door. She was a guest on my show last month. A great book and great lady. So if you can make it, it's in Manhattan. You can go to the Behind the Kitchen Door Facebook page and find out the location of that. On April 21st, Slow Food Huntington is welcoming their new board of directors. Oh, that was very exciting. On Friday, we elected in a new board of directors for Slow Food Huntington. So I will miss Ann Rathkoff, who has been my co-chair for 5 years. She was doing it on her own before I joined her, and she's stepping down to focus on some other things. She will stay an active member, but I now have a board of directors of 6 other people plus myself. So 7 of us will take this chapter forward, and I'm really looking forward to working with them. There's also a Green Festival coming up at the Javits Center, April 20th and 21st, if you are in the New York area for that. So what else is going on? There's so much. You know, I'm sure you guys saw in the news about the monarch butterflies. They are, you know, there's been a real decrease in the monarch butterflies due to the lack of milkweed in the grasslands, and also all the GMOs we're planting. And that would be really, really sad if we had no more monarch butterflies. And also there's, you know, all the debris and runoff from pigs and all of the manure that they produce both in this country and around the world. And there was just a big article on pigs that were floating down the river in China because the pigs were contaminated and they didn't know how to get rid of them, so they just were throwing them into the Shanghai River in China, and there was over 6,000 dead pigs that turned up on shore. And so, you know, the issue of raising meat in this industrial agricultural way that we are doing it is just an unsustainable process. And we all need to think about that and look at our diets and look at ways that we can not contribute to this system that is not working and that is not going to be able to take us forward into the future. So that's just a little food for thought for all of us. You know, if we are going to still continue to eat meat, to please make sure that we purchase it from people that are raising it in a sustainable manner, both for the animal's sake and also for our health and well-being of the planet. So before I invite my guests on, as always, I want to share with you a recipe. This recipe is a seaweed salad. I'm using arame with edamame, and it's a wonderful recipe. And I haven't made it in a while, and I'll share with you why. And I actually decided that I'm going to do a little research, and I'll report back to all of you about the quality of the arame. You know, it is coming from Japan. And after Fukushima, you know, I really saw myself cutting down, not right away, because I figured, you know, the packaged seaweed was packaged before Fukushima had happened. But now that we are a few years after Fukushima, you know, I'm wondering about the quality of the seaweed coming out of Japan, and from that matter, any of the foods out of Japan. I was shocked when I went to a Japanese restaurant, or many Japanese restaurants now, and I find out that almost all of the seaweed salad being served in Japanese restaurants is coming from Japan. They import it, and it's already pre-made, and they're not making it there. So if you're at a Japanese restaurant, you might want to just ask them if they're making their own seaweed salad. But anyway, it's just food for thought. You know, is the seaweed contaminated from radiation from Fukushima? And I can't really say. But because so much of our food system is contaminated, that's why I have come to this philosophy of trying to really eat a wider spectrum than one might otherwise, and not eat a lot of any one same food. Really rotate your diet around so that you're getting lots of different ingredients from lots of different sources, or lots of different vitamins from lots of different sources, and just don't eat too much of one thing. Anyway, for the arame salad with edamame, you need 1 package of arame that you're going to soak in some boiling water for 10 minutes, 2 carrots cut into julienne strips, 1 large or 2 small onions cut into slivers, 1 cup of shelled edamame, and I buy organic shelled edamame in the frozen food section. And they are organic, of course. Definitely make sure you're getting all your soybeans organic, because they are almost guaranteed to be genetically modified if they are not organic. Tamari, to taste, 2 tablespoons of aji mirin, which is a sweet rice wine, 1 teaspoon of grated ginger, 2 cloves garlic minced, 1 teaspoon dark sesame oil, and olive oil. And so you're going to cover the bottom of a cast iron pan with some oil and saute the onions for about 5 minutes. And once the onions start getting soft and translucent, at that point add the carrots, the garlic, and the ginger. And if you like a lot of garlic and ginger, which I do, you can double the amount that I just said and add, you know, I think I added a whole tablespoon of grated ginger because I really like that flavor. Cook for another 5 minutes. Then drain the arame, reserving the liquid, and add the drained arame to the saucepan and saute for another 5 minutes. Then add back a half a cup of the saved arame water and simmer it for 10 more minutes. Add the cup of edamame and simmer for another 5 minutes. Add the tamari, the mirin, and the dark sesame oil at the end for seasonings. Adjust for taste. So you're going to taste it. If you like it salty, you can add a little more tamari. If you like a little more of that sesame flavor, you can add some more of the dark sesame oil. And if you want it a little sweeter, you add a little more mirin. And this dish can be served either hot, right off out of the pan, or at room temperature, or cold as a salad. If you want to make it a complete meal, you can also saute some tofu on the side, or I do it on the side so I can get it really crispy and then add it into it. Or you can even just add some cubed tofu into this dish for some protein and serve it that way as well. So that is it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce my guests, Priscilla Timberlake and Lewis Friedman. Priscilla is a mother of four. She spent a lot of time in the kitchen and loves cooking and teaching cooking classes at her home and also at a local cooperative market. She teaches personal growth and wellness classes at Cornell University. Priscilla loves working with the students and meeting students from all over the world. She's also an ordained minister of the healing arts. And Lewis Friedman is her husband and dad and a registered dietitian. He also teaches yoga and stress management classes at Cornell University. As an instructor of an online certificate program in plant-based nutrition, he teaches for E. Cornell and the Colin Campbell Foundation. Lewis is directly involved with the growing global movement towards embracing a whole plant-based diet. And this book is basically is a plant-based diet cookbook. And the thing that's really interesting about this cookbook is that it is geared for large gatherings. So Priscilla and Lewis, are you with me?
Oh, yeah. Hi.
Hi. Welcome. Welcome. You know, one first question I have for you, since you do so much cooking with seaweeds, what is your concern about the radiation contamination with seaweeds? Do you know that question that I posed earlier in the show?
I just love hearing you talk about this. And by the way, what a wonderful thing you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Amazing. Wow, what great work.
Thank
great
you
service.
So much. So do you have any idea? Do you have any idea about radiation contamination?
Oh, yeah, I'm thinking about it because that was an interesting discussion. I've been getting my stuff from a company called Natural Import Company. And I'm going on, this whole question came up, and they assured us that they were, you know, going to get the sea vegetables from the, you know, cleanest, purest possible, and assured us that everything was going to, you know, be fine. So I've been buying from this company for a real long time. I had a big warehouse down in Asheville. Was it North Carolina, right?
Yeah, that's the one I need, Pacific Sun. Right?
Excuse me?
Pacific Sun in North Carolina?
It's called Natural Import Company.
Okay.
And I've been going there for years. I mean, I went into a warehouse filled with stuff a long time ago. It was so much fun. So there was a whole discussion, and I just, you know, got to trust that they know what they're doing as far as getting it. And like yourself, I think some of these sea vegetables have been packaged in, you know, a several-year supply. But it is a very good question.
Yeah. I have a hard time just trusting. Unfortunately, I am a trusting person. And, you know, if I go to a farmer's market and somebody says they don't spray but they're not certified organic, I trust them. You know, I'm face-to-face with them, I trust them. But when we're talking about big corporations and companies, you know, profit is where, you know, is their bottom line. And so I have a really hard time. And so, you know, anyway, I am aware that I've been eating less. Well, you know, I have to do my research because I've been aware that I've been eating a little bit less seaweed just because I have been concerned about that. I mean, there's the Maine coast seaweed, which is great, but they don't have arame or hiziki. They have dulce
Exactly. Well, I would check the Natural Import because they have articles on their website, and they're kind of, you know, they've been a company that's been around for a long time. But I would certainly question some of these sea vegetables from, you know, China as well, if it's not, you know, certified organic or are they grown next to industries. Those are all really good questions.
Because, I mean, even some of the fish that they're catching off the coast of California is having radiation contamination from Fukushima.
So it's a good question.
Well, yes, this is Lewis.
Hi, Lewis. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. I just want to add in one thing here. The other piece, the interesting part about sea vegetables and this question of radiation is that sea vegetables have been used and were used, you know, in Japan after, during and right after World War II to actually help. To help people remove seaweed, the effects of radiation from their body. So it actually has, you know, that counter positive effect. So I guess as we're speaking about it, I guess the effect of the sea vegetables pulling radiation out of your body may actually, in some regard, it's helpful, but it may concentrate the radiation.
Right. I mean, it might be pulling the radiation out of the water, but then it goes into the seaweed. You know, because
but the reason
I know
it gets it out of your body is it binds it in a form that then your body does not assimilate it.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually binds it. So maybe, you know, hopefully that it would, if there is somewhat of a problem, that it would pass through your body in this bound form, I guess. But it's theoretical, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting research. I'm going to see what I can find because I know I also was eating a lot of miso soup after I was pregnant during Three Mile Island. That spill. And so I know eating miso soup does that too. Eating miso soup is supposed to be very good for pulling radiation out of the body. Have you heard that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also the sea vegetable that's also in the miso soup at the time. That was.
Uh-huh. Right.
So that's the compounding effect, the benefit of it, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, these American sea vegetables are really nice, too. Different quality. We get the dulse. We get ours from Lars Hansen. He calls himself the seaweed man. And he's come to our dinners and given slideshows on his sea vegetables. And we see how he harvested the Maine, the dulse, the kelp, the laria, all really good, solid sea vegetables from, you know, this country.
From
and
Maine,
also
right?
Also really very good for you.
Does he get it from Maine?
Yeah, he has a company there. He is the seaweed. He calls himself the Seaweed Man. Maine Seaweed is what he calls it, which is different than
right.
the other seaweed company. And he's absolute Lars Hansen. He's fantastic. He takes apprentices. They come up. They go on the boat. They get up at 3 a.m. And actually, his production. People wanted it so much more after Japan. It was like
right.
sixfold. They couldn't even keep up
I'm
with
sure.
the amount of work.
Right, right. That's what I was talking about, the Maine Coast seaweed. Excellent.
Well, it's different. It's a different company. He's worth looking into because he is 100% committed to harvesting responsibly. He'll only harvest a certain amount from a bed so it can regenerate, and he pays attention to what oil he puts on his boats that he takes out to harvest.
Uh-huh.
And the Maine company.
I'll look him up, the Seaweed Man.
Yeah, his name is Lars Hansen. Because the Maine Coast company that you're speaking about is a much larger company. He's a, you know, he'll sell his, you know, he'll sell his seconds to Maine Coast.
Okay. Okay.
And this is what you're talking. This guy comes all the way down from Maine.
Okay.
To give us a talk right after the what happened in Japan. Only took a couple things. I had like a full house, 55, 60 people to our dinners. He didn't even want to take any orders. He didn't even want to get involved with selling this product. He came here and gave a slideshow. He spoke from his heart how important it all is. And that was a huge drive, like 12 hours.
Right.
And 12 hours back just because he's so into what he's doing.
Right, right.
And that's amazing.
Well, thank you.
And
I will definitely
look him up. He writes poetry about the sea vegetables.
Good. Good. Lots of farmers do. I have another farmer friend who's also a poet. So can I just ask you, for starting with your book, which is beautiful, by the way, thank you so much, what made you do the book for large gatherings?
Yeah, Blue, I'll let you start with that. Take it away.
It's what we know. We've just been doing these gatherings at our house. Oh, more than 20 years ago, we started doing... our house became a gathering place for music events and different things, and there were potluck dinners, and eventually people started asking us to cook dinner and for them, and we started having these dinners, and there's some other pieces of it that Priscilla could address, but basically for almost 20 years we've been having these once-a-week dinners where we prepare the whole meal. And then the reason we wanted to do this book for large gatherings was that we could see and feel when people come the... how much people benefit. It's not, it is about the food, but it's also about coming together with people and sitting down at the end of their day and just sharing, you know, at a large table with other people. And that kind of community, that camaraderie, that is just seems so healing. So we wanted to continue that and write this book to help inspire, if other people are inspired to gather together with friends. And it's going to be a hopeful thing, but to... the other thing is people are always going to potlucks or dish to passes, and they're always, you know, looking for a recipe that size. And if we could support that, because when we bring a recipe like that to a dinner, people get inspired. They're usually the first thing that gets eaten. So it's a way to help. It's a way to help educate as well.
Right.
So those couple pieces. And Priscilla might want to add another piece to actually why we're starting. That's my take on it. Oh, thank you.
Okay, yeah. So for those of you listening, it's actually called The Great Life Cookbook, and we have a website, greatlifecookbook.com. People asked us to do a cookbook, to tell you the honest truth, after many years of doing this. And Lewis and I are like, oh, my gosh, that sounds like so complicated. And then we wrapped ourselves around it, and it took us 3 years, and the process was incredible. You know, you learn a lot in the process. And we had 3 potluck recipe testing of the recipes where people, this is my daughter-in-law who did the apprentice section and some of the photos, she suggested, Alicia, that people take the recipes home and do it in their own house and then write comments and bring it here. And the first one we did, we had 70 people participate and brought all their the recipes they printed out. This is before the book went to print, and comments. So this has really been a community process actually producing the book.
Oh, I love that idea.
Yeah, it's really exciting. And I felt like a professor. I had a stack look like term papers. I was like, oh, my God, I got to go through that?
Uh-huh.
You know, I thought the recipes were fine the way they were. So it has been a real process of refinement and learning and education and sticking with the project. And for all you listeners who know anything about self-publishing, oh, my gosh, what a commitment and task that is when you decide to go that way.
Mm-hmm.
And we also went with 100% recycled, which is a whole other level of education and commitment because it's a lot more expensive, just like organic. We paid, you know, so much to have the book printed because we chose to do it this way. And it's just another level of commitment to, you know, sustainable living.
Right.
And
walking the walk.
Yeah.
Walking the walk. Yeah. I know it's much easier to talk the walk, and then when you have to pay for it, to walk the walk too is hard sometimes.
Exactly.
I understand.
Like
completely.
We drive these funky cars, but we eat really well. You know what I mean? We don't compromise on eating one bit, you know?
Right. I'm
so
sure.
We have our interesting priorities.
Well, the same in my family. I'd say the majority of our money goes towards eating well. And now the book is based mostly on macrobiotics. Can you share a little bit of the philosophy of macrobiotics for my listeners? I'm not sure if everyone's aware of that.
Yeah, I'll start and then Priscilla can pick up. I'll start with the title of the book, The Great Life Cookbook. Macrobiotics is a philosophy of looking at life as everything matters, everything's integrated. A great, like, it's a big view, macrobiotics, meaning large biology, large view of the world. So the idea of macrobiotics, there's some specifics to it, but the philosophy is that everything makes a difference. In other words, if you eat local food versus food that's shipped 3,000 miles, you know, that's going to make a difference. Or if you eat, if you cook with gas stove that has a steadiness of flame versus an electric stove that has a, you know, alternating current, or if you cook food that's a long, slow stewing versus a raw food, it's not like one is necessarily better or worse, but it's an acknowledgement that it is different. So that's the broader philosophy, and then maybe Priscilla can speak more about how that actually plays out in the food.
Yeah, I think what Lewis is referring to is like energy. Like, we're all energy. You know, we're composed of energy, and it, food has energy, and it affects you energetically. Like salt would be a contracting thing, pull your energy in, salt, and we need good quality salt. And then sweet, which we need too, like mother's breast milk is sweet. It's a natural, one of the, you know, the natural taste that we need is sweet, which is more expansive. So macrobiotics talks about balance, like knowing yourself, knowing your contractions and expansions within yourself, and also know how, like, food affects that. And, Michio Kushi and Avon Kushi brought it to United States, and it's really been quite remarkable, the whole movement, or philosophy.
Mm-hmm. In reading your book, I was looking at the little symbol that you have on page 18 about fire, wood, water, metal, earth, and how each element is connected to a season and to a taste. So fire is summer and bitter, and wood is spring and sour. Can you explain a little bit about the five element theory?
Well, that goes back to the Chinese five theory of Chinese medicine. And just what you said, that each season's connected with an emotion, a body part, a food season, and it's really, you know, very fascinating. Christina Perelli talks about it. She's a very well-known cook and chef out of Philadelphia. And also Marianne Coleman, she first wrote the book. Lewis, what was her name? Is her book again?
There's the whole meal. No.
Natural Gourmet.
Natural Gourmet.
Well, I know the Natural Gourmet Institute is no longer macrobiotic. It used to be macrobiotic. It's not anymore, but it's still, you know, certainly
the Natural Gourmet. Yeah, anyway, so she really got into it, and so these cooks and authors inspired me, and I studied it for about a year, and I just started playing with it. Okay, red cabbage is this, da-da-da-da-da, and started making these plates using all five theories, using all five elements, and it just felt really right. It felt, like, natural, and it's really it's just very interesting and fun.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I ran the cafeteria at the Waldorf School in Garden City, I did a lot of work with Rudolf Steiner's theory in biodynamics and his theory around food. And he also had different colors for the day of the week, different temperaments, should eat different foods, the root vegetable contained one element as opposed to eating the leaf of the vegetable or the flower of the vegetable. And it was really so interesting, and I'd love to look at some of these side by side and see how much they correlate, because so often when you find these different theories, there's so many interrelated basics
to them.
Yeah, I had that book in my book of Rudolf Steiner in my hand that addressed that at one point. I'm looking at my shelf now, I don't see it, but he was amazing.
Right.
I mean, a visionary, and the things he came up with, and his whole way of looking at the development of a child in stages. It was just brilliant. I used him, all my kids, and my son went to Waldorf school for a while. It's just fascinating.
Yeah.
They all...
Yeah, it's really amazing. And so I bet there's a lot of correlations here.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have so many questions to ask you, but before we get into it anymore, I'd like to take a couple-minute break, and we'll be back in just a little bit. Everybody who's listening, I'm speaking with Priscilla Timberlake and Lewis Friedman, the authors of The Great Life Cookbook. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Bhavani and I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guests today are Priscilla Timberlake and Lewis Friedman. They are the authors of a wonderful new cookbook called The Great Life Cookbook, Whole Food, Vegan, Gluten-Free Meals for Large Gatherings. Welcome back, Lewis and Priscilla.
Hello, hello.
So, I wanted to know, in your experience with working with large, you know, cooking so often for large groups, do you find that kids are open to this food? Because my experience is they are. And I, of course, work with so many parents who find, like, kids don't like this, kids don't like that. But that hasn't been my experience. How are you with this food?
Excellent question. Excellent question. Yeah, the kids are very, very open to it. But, you know... It's not, the kids will have one day where they don't like this, they don't like that, and I think the thing is not to make a big deal about it. The thing, you make a big deal about it, then they identify as that being who they are, and they start building on it. So I feel like a lightness of touch with kids is a good idea, and you keep working with it, and, you know, greens, patties, steamed squash, they love all that, and they like my experience is the younger the kid, the simpler. They don't like a lot of mixing. So you give them the brown rice and just the simple greens and nothing too fancy, and it seems to work.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is a fabulous food for kids. I think the problem, too, arises when if the kid is older and you start introducing stuff and it's not familiar. So you have to be a little more clever, do
mm-hmm.
substitutions that are similar to what you used to do. What they used to have.
Right.
Lewis, you want to add something on this?
No, I think the simple is the key.
Right.
The kids don't like, you know, if you give them plain squash, they'll love it. You give them straight greens, just cooked greens. The kids are really, yes, they like good food, simple food. Like
yeah,
good food.
You know, it's interesting. I have a 10-year spread between my oldest child and my youngest child. And the difference from when my oldest one would go to school and I'd send her with nori rolls, which now, of course, everyone thinks of as sushi. I'd send her with nori rolls, and people made fun of her. And her name's Saisha, and she was actually teased. People called her sushi, you know?
Aww.
And then my youngest one, I had to send 4 nori rolls every time I sent her nori rolls because everybody would eat them. It was
yeah.
such a different experience because then, it, you know, everybody was big on sushi by then, and you know, and because it looked familiar, you know, the fact that there was no fish in the middle didn't matter to them. You know, everybody would eat it, and I had to make enough for her to share with everybody.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
You're right about making foods that are familiar, because people were familiar with sushi now. They loved it. When my kids were little, I know I used to make tofu parmesan all the time for their friends who would come over and eat, just because, again, that was a familiar type of thing. They were used to chicken parmesan, so tofu parmesan was pretty close, and they would
love
it.
And then teenage years, they need a little more richness, you know? So, you know, we were like sweet potato fries and things like that, you know? I think it just like what Steiner said, each, you know, kid is in a different developmental stage and has kind of different needs in a way. So you would adjust what you're giving, whether they're young or old. You know, a really athletic kid would need a little more richness in their diet.
Mm-hmm.
More calories, you know, sustainable.
Right, of course.
Food.
Now, what makes a balanced plate of food? You know, going back to those five elements, like, do you think of that on every plate that you put together?
Absolutely, absolutely. Bruce and I both can address this. He's, so something with, you know, green and different vegetables that are of ground, underground, protein, a grain, and it all happens to match that five-phase theory. It's like you said, it's amazing how all these different things come back to the same essence in the end. I know Lewis has this rainbow theory he likes to talk about, so I'll put him on here. He loves his little rainbow discussion.
There's a couple of pieces that and Priscilla might be talking about. But one, Priscilla really does. The way we work together is Priscilla really does. She incorporates the five phase theory, and she's thinking about, you know, the salty, the sour, the different seasons. And then she shows me the menu, and I don't understand it intellectually, but I look at it and say, wow, there's a little too much, you know, a little too much salt here, or we need a little more bright color to add. We visualize in our mind when we're thinking about what the meal is, and I visualize it on the plate, and I think about the colors and the rainbow, and exactly what she said, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess Priscilla was probably referring to, there's a little part in the beginning of the book, that we each wrote a section, and I wrote a section, and I said in there was a piece of nutrition advice. The first piece of nutrition advice that really resonated with me, that stuck with me to this day, is a while ago we were at a wedding, and there was an MD that I was speaking with, and I was asking, we were talking about nutrition, and he told me, and this is a while ago, he said, I just tell all my patients, or when people ask me, I tell them just eat from every color of the rainbow and every part of the plant each day, and you will be just fine.
Uh-huh.
Not to worry.
It's so funny you say that, because I do a slow food in school program, and I go into nursery schools with, you know, representing slow food, and I always make rainbow vegetable soup, and I talk to them about eating like a rainbow. Because especially to children, you can't tell them you want to get vitamin A, you want to get vitamin C, you want to get, you know, or that, you know, carrot has vitamin A and orange has vitamin C. Kids can't relate to that. But if you just say eat all the colors, it's so true. You're going to get all the different vitamins that you need.
They all show up there.
Yeah, isn't that amazing that it is scientifically and nutritionally solid advice, actually.
It is, and it's so simple.
And I think the life force, like, is important. Like when I talked about energy, like the life force of the food. You want to eat something that feels alive and feels vibrant, because you want more life. You want to be alive and vibrant. So it's how you cook things is really important. Like when you blanch things just right, so you just start the process, the cooking, but it's still full of nutrients and absorbable, and everything looks bright and colorful. Which is it's an art, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you overcook things, it just doesn't have the same feeling, doesn't look the same, and, you know, even looking at it, and you're like not as enthusiastic to eat it.
Right.
So I think it's a whole art to, like, cooking, where you just learn how to maximize nutrition and the life force through cooking.
Right. And also looking at the plate as a canvas, so that.
Right.
So that when you bring a plate to somebody and they're looking at the plate, that it's colorful, that it's something that they want to dig into.
We
screened a movie last night at our local cinema called Step Up to the Plate.
Ooh.
And it's about a four-star chef in France, Michael Braz, and about the tradition of him passing down his restaurant to his son. But the part that was so beautiful was the artfulness of preparing and the thought that went into each plate. I mean, you know, down to like the swish of the color of the little dab of the sauce, you know, I mean, everything. And so, you know, I'm also a private chef, and when I am designing a menu for my clients, you know, I think of, you know, what vegetable am I going to do with this main course, because I want the plate, when they are putting the food onto their plate, to be colorful and balanced in color. And you know, it's so important. And kids eat, they eat first with their eyes before they even taste it. And so if it looks bad, they're not going to want to eat it. And I've gone into school cafeterias, and I've been shocked. I don't know if you're aware of this, but in so many schools, our local school, they don't even give the kids plates. They literally ladle the food right onto the tray that has compartments. And, you know, sometimes they're plastic trays, and sometimes they're these heavy cardboard wooden trays that are disposable. But not even a plate. It goes right onto the tray, and it's just, I don't think you make anything look good on that, you know, when it's served like that.
Oh, gosh. It makes me think of TV dinners.
Yeah, TV dinners. It makes me think of, you know, Oliver. Please, sir, can I have some more? You know, just being ladled like that. It's just, you know, going through the line and just being, you know, food just plopped on their plate. It's just, it's really horrible.
Yeah.
Well, on a positive note, like, here in Ithaca, New York, everybody knows about our very famous Ithaca Farmers Market, which is like the swinging place to be on a Saturday morning.
I've been there.
And
it
a
is
good
wonderful.
Friend of ours, Peggy Aker, has a stand called Macro Mamas. And she is chef supreme, and as far as like artistic, she's just amazing. And you wouldn't believe the line she has on Saturdays, selling the food, Macro Mama. And people that don't usually eat this way, and they see that food in these huge bowls at the market with the greens and the reds and the yellows and the oranges and how it's displayed. And I have learned a lot from her, because we've done some really big gigs together, like huge festivals where we've cooked. And it's just, it's exactly what you're saying. I mean, it's like you are drawn to that food.
Right, right. Now, I notice in your recipes, most of your desserts, you're using rice syrup as opposed to, of course, you're not going to use conventional sugar, but even rice syrup as opposed to honey or maple syrup that often. Can you explain why?
Sure can, because that the rice syrup is still, the sugar change is still long, a more complex carbohydrate. So it goes into your system slower, more gentle than white sugar, which goes right into your bloodstream, affects your pancreas, and it's just an evener, mellower, balanced way of taking in sweet. Lewis, you want to add something?
Yeah.
He's our resident nutritionist.
Yeah, but also, this is true. I mean, I love rice syrup, and it is gentle. But also, the honey is also... I mean, for a couple of things, the honey has a lot of fructose in it. Again, that's a really short-chain sugar. The honey is a much shorter-chain sugar than the rice syrup. And also, for the honey, actually, for some people, you know, we called the cookbook is vegan. For some people who choose to eat a vegan diet do prefer not to eat honey for other reasons. So we just got out of the habit. We just don't really... You know, we just don't really use it. And then we use a little bit of maple syrup. We're up here in maple syrup country, and we use the maple syrup really for the flavor. So we'll get the bulk of the sweetness on something with the rice syrup because it's more gentle on the body, and then we'll add a little maple syrup to bring up that, you know, that little bit sweet and that nice, rich, smoky flavor, that maple syrup. So we use that combination a lot,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. What's your theory on agave? That has a lot of mixed publicity.
Yeah, well, if we're going to ask that question, we have to take us back to the macrobiota question, because the agave is from a desert plant, from a cactus, and we live in the Northeast. Not that they grow a lot of rice here, but it could, you know, in similar cultures, but in similar environments. But the agave is just... From a macrobiotic perspective, it's very yin. It's a very quick reacting, sweet from a, you know, a tropical plant in that way. So we just never got, you know, we started to try it a little bit. Priscilla could talk about it. I don't think we ever could quite figure out how to use it or get the flavor of it. But then we just stayed with the macrobiotic principles and the agave syrup and maple syrup. But Priscilla, I don't know what you would add about agave.
Well, I think when you say experience, too, I think that going through our own experience in our own bodies, rice syrup just tastes more like wholesome, like grounded, like, you know, extension of rice. It just feels like when I make desserts, and if I don't use a lot of rice syrup, maybe I use, you know, way more maple syrup because I want a certain effect. It just tastes more like, you know, like it just goes to your head a little bit more, where rice syrup, I feel like, is just a little more easier going. It just feels like a base, a richer base.
Mm-hmm.
And we get it by, like, 60-pound buckets, Suzanne Specialties, which is actually down near your way in New Jersey. So we got it, like, 60 pounds of it in our basement, you know, at a time. So we really got in a nice relationship with rice syrup.
Right, right. And I guess barley syrup you just avoid because it has gluten in it.
Yeah, you know, like Lewis said, you know, we, in our own house, we'll eat a little honey, we'll eat a little this, but with our Friday dinners in the cookbook, we have go for the lowest common denominator. We want everybody that comes here to feel really happy and accommodate everybody. So that's when we started going gluten-free about 5 years ago, because every fourth person was gluten-free.
Right, right.
So
I've been doing that, too. When I cook for a large group, you know, it's so easy to use a rice noodle instead of a wheat noodle. Why not, you know?
Exactly. So as far as the book we're trying to make it available for as many, you know, people as possible. And we do have an apprentice section, because we realize and we've gotten feedback that some of these foods are new to people.
Mm-hmm.
And so they go to the back, and it talks about, you know, misos and rice syrup. And you know, it's kind of a fast, I tell people, you know, don't let that limit you. I mean, how many years ago was tofu, nobody knew what it is, and now look at it. It's like everywhere, even in, like, you know, places you wouldn't even expect it, people know what tofu is, but it wasn't known that well. I mean, when I grew up in Staten Island in the 60s, like, I didn't have tofu around.
Right.
I was always around, but it wasn't like a common thing. You know, so I think it's with this new movement, like the new movement with the radio show, all the new energy, like, you know, trying, willing to try and have new foods in your diet is just really what it's about. Like, you know, whether it's sea vegetables or some rice syrup or, you know, more different kinds of greens you never had. I think just expanding what your habits are.
Right. Well, two other ingredients that you use a lot in your recipes that I know it explains it in the back of the book, but maybe you can just share with people, because I know they've been ones that I've come across, I know that I use in my cooking, kuzu and agar, both thickening agents. Can you explain a little bit about them and,
yeah, and
how you
know,
would use, how you
were talking
them differently?
About the Japanese thing, and when it first happened in Japan, and you know, everybody's feeling so, you know, it's really a sad thing that happened. And my next reaction after feeling sad for every people involved was like, oh my God, my cookbook is like every recipe is agar. I'll never have agar again. I love agar. It is a freeze-dried sea vegetable made of like four or five red sea vegetables and processed in a really special way that is, you can now have vegetarian jello. It's a thickener, and it's just absolutely amazing. Four or five tablespoons to a quarter liquid. You boil it up, and you have this wonderful gel. And I just totally love it.
Uh-huh.
And I've shared it with so many people, and it's just a really magical ingredient. It's also really good for you, lots of calcium, and just great, a great addition to the kitchen.
Now, I have a question that I'm not sure if you know the answer, but as you're saying it, the question just coming to me. Is agar in the same family as carrageenan? Because I'm sure you've been reading about that, and that is a thickener that's added to many different products, especially, you know, a lot of organic products, too, and people are questioning it, trying to get it out of organics now. They use it in soy milk and almond milk, kind of as a thickening to make the consistency better, and it also comes from a red sea vegetable.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I think they're in the same line, absolutely.
Right,
I mean,
and people thought it was fine, and now they're finding that it's that even food-grade carrageenan, which has been approved to be in organic foods, is carcinogenic, and that it's being connected to colon cancer and to a lot of the stomach and digestive issues that people are having. Have you been hearing about this?
I have not heard of that, but I know Lewis, you hear more, Lewis, with his online class, he's in touch with latest scientific things.
I know. Cornucopia Institute wrote a big thing about the carrageenan, and there's a big movement in the, Organic Valley has committed to getting it out of their products by 2015.
Wow.
It's really of concern for people. I know I've been, not hunting for almond milk that doesn't have that in it, and it's hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if it's in the same family, and because agar's not as commonly used in foods here, it's not being looked into in the same way, but I'm wondering if it's at all connected and if we have to be concerned about that.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. What makes me think about it, I actually do not, I've kind of heard that discussion on the outs edges of my brain somewhere, but I haven't looked at it. But what I first come to mind when hearing you speak and thinking about carrageenan and agar-agar is that I think of, and what I would want to look into is the process of making it. My instinct is that the agar, or agar, is more of a whole food, that it's kind of the whole sea vegetable dried and just dried and broken into like flakes that we use. And my impression would be, and this is speaking out of ignorance at the moment, but I have a pretty strong feeling about it, is that there's a much more of a manufacturing process to make that carrageenan. And I think that's where the problems occur.
Right.
That's where we go when we go from whole foods to processed foods. And I think my guess would be that that's what we're talking about here.
And it's not even whole foods to processed foods as much as, I think, as much as not industrial food, but food processing in general. I mean, there was a whole new study that came out that the organic milks are having PCBs in it because of the plastic tubing.
In the manufacturing process, it's added in.
No, it's not that it's added in. It's the plastic tubing from when they milk
the
cows.
Well, that's what I mean. It's a byproduct of the process.
Right, exactly. When they're milking the cows, the warm milk is going through the plastic tubes, and the PCBs are leaching out of the plastic tubes into the... Oh, no, we're out of time.
Well, anyway, I just want to agree with you on that one about the process. Like, even agar-agar powder feels different when I use it energetically to the agar-agar flakes, which feels it's been used for, a long, long time in Japan.
Right, right. Well, Phil and Lewis, I'm going to have you on again because I haven't finished asking all the questions, but we are out of time.
It was so much fun.
It was great. Thank you so much.
For all
again,
doing.
Why don't you share your website really fast before we run out of time?
Good, Lou.
Oh, it's thegreatlifecookbook.com. You can find us and look us up and order a book and spread the word and get everybody enjoying and eating together and eating good, wholesome food.
Great. Well, I will come to one of your dinners, and if you're in New York, please come to one of mine. And thank you so much for joining us.